there. My name is Rachel Harkin. I'm the Head of Employment Advice Services at Independent Living Group, trading as ILG Support. In the last podcast season, we were talking about some key issues that really affect individual employers. We had a focus on employment law, and we also looked at some social welfare principles. This season, however, we're going about things slightly differently to bring you something of interest. So I'm going to hand over to David Ashley, who's going to tell you more.
Thanks, Rachel. I'm David Ashley from the Independent Living Group, self-confessed direct payments nerd. Also really excited about season two of the podcast, where we are going to be interviewing Independent Living Group, community steering group members and individual employers, hearing from them all about their experiences employing personal assistants. So Sato, here in your house, so thank you so much for having us. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, my name's Sato. I no longer employ carers, but I did for a period of 3 years.
And you did employ carers, and you employed them to support, not you, but to support...
No, my partner.
Your partner, Lawrence. And we can talk about Lawrence today a little bit. So there's so much to talk about with you. I've been, you know, really lucky, I think, to get to know you over the last year or two, and you've been involved in the Independent Living Group community quite heavily. But I guess, I think we'll come on to that. But I think by way as a starter, we want these podcasts to be of use and interest to people who might be thinking about taking a direct payment or a personal health budget, which it was in your case. So I guess, could I ask you, how were you first introduced to direct payments and personal health budgets? And what was the first time you even heard about them as an option?
I used to work at a hospital, and I was asked to investigate how personal health budgets could help the patients of the hospital. So obviously there were complementary treatments involved, which rather than the conventional. There was conventional as well, but some of them wanted homeopathy or herbal medicine, acupuncture and so on. So the clinical director asked me to investigate how personal health budgets could help the patients of the hospital that may require that kind of support. So that's how I actually came across what they were. At that time, I didn't know I would need to know on a more personal level how you got them and what they involve. What I did discover while I was looking into them was that there was nothing that made it clear cut. There was no, they call it a budget, but you haven't got a budget. You have to say what you want and how much you need it and why you need it. And then they decide whether you can have that and how much of it they'll pay for. So there was no real guidance. It was a very nebulous...
No framework.
Yeah. And each individual, it would depend on which part of London or wherever they were coming from, which postcode area they were in, really. Mm. So I was actually involved in doing that when I had to go on sabbatical because of my partner. Which was interesting, could not find a way of writing a briefing paper about personal health budgets and how to go about getting them, because you have to involve somebody who writes a support care plan. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it's called. There's initials they use for it, but basically it's a risk assessment of why you need it, what will happen if you don't get it, what happens if you do get it, that kind of thing.
So just to take it back a step then, so you understood what personal health budgets were because of your professional connection. You've been asked to look into them. So, and you ended up needing a personal health budget for Lawrence. So when, I assume there was an assessment of Lawrence's kind of needs at that point, was there a, what was offered by the CCG then?
Well,
was it your understanding of PHBs? Or
no, nothing was offered. In 2015, Lawrence ostensibly went into a hospital for respite. And I think the respite was for me, not for him. And when he went in, he was a certain weight, certain strength. He was ill, yes. He'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's in his mid-40s. And now he was, 2015, he was 62 or something like that. But dementia had come into the equation. We didn't have carers at that point, and I was very often having to drop work and come home and so on. So then I had to go on a sabbatical so that I could be here. Wasn't getting sleep and so on. So the Parkinson's nurse felt that it was a good idea to have Lawrence go into this hospital for rehab for a couple of weeks, give me a break, and maybe to help him, because they would do rehabilitation, sort of teach him how to walk with equipment and so on. Didn't work. I think after day one, they decided that there was nothing they could do with him. He was in there for 10 days. He lost a lot of weight. And unbeknownst to me, they put a deprivation of liberty order on him. Is that what that's called?
Potentially a
doll's, I don't know. But anyway, he was begging me to get him out. He wasn't eating. He had a puncture, a needle wound, where they'd obviously injected him. It wasn't on the medicine sheet. I couldn't get anybody to tell me what he'd been injected with. So I decided I was taking him home. I was told I couldn't because of this deprivation of liberty order, and I said, well, I've got power of attorney, I'm taking him home. So I had to sign a waiver saying that I was doing so against medical advice. They did provide a hospital bed. He had to stay there for a couple of days while they sorted out a hospital bed. We had to rip out the carpet, put flooring down for the moving hoist. I was told you could only use the standing hoist with two people. And I said, well, there's only him and me. So I'm going to have to use it on my own. Anyway, we got him home. The doctor had told me that he'd got at most 2 years to live. And I suspect he would have had 2 weeks to live if he'd have stayed there, truthfully. Anyway, he came home. They put in, I don't know what they call it, but it's when you come out of hospital, up to 6 weeks, you have carers that come.
A reablement package, I think.
Is that what it's called?
Sometimes referred to, yeah.
Yeah, so if you only need them for 2 weeks, that you have them for 2 weeks, but it's up to 6 weeks that you get them for 20 minutes, something to get him up or get him to bed or whatever. But it doesn't work, truthfully, because sometimes they turn up at 11 o'clock at night. And that's not the visiting carers' fault. It's because they're sent here, there and everywhere. They're usually on public transport, or very frequently on public transport. And if they're stuck somewhere else, coming here at 11 o'clock at night, you've already done what you need to do. So that kind of package of care is not very helpful, actually. It's not helpful at all. But he was in such a bad way that he didn't put up any fight about it. I mean, this is a 6'3" independent person normally, and he didn't put up any arguments about being washed when they did come. So that shows a level of how ill he was. After the 6 weeks, or coming towards the end of the 6 weeks, they're saying, well, what happens now? Because his condition has so deteriorated from when he went into the hospital to coming home. I can't lift him. What do we do? And the only help I got really was at Age UK. Richmond Age UK. Sorry, I shouldn't name names. Cut that out.
That's all right, no, we can.
So
I think we can plug Richmond Age UK.
Age UK were really helpful, but not in hindsight. You can see that they don't have all the information either. But the fact that they had any and were of any help was brilliant. Somehow we got a council carer person. I really don't know how that came about. That might have been Age UK. But I was told that we could choose an agency to take over from the rehabilitation package. Mm-hmm. When it came to that, we didn't have a choice. There was only one that we could have. I said, well, that's not much of a choice, is it? It's like, well, it's the only one that's available. So, okay, fair enough. So we had them coming in, and they, I think, did three visits a day. But most of the time I'd say don't bother, because right. I'd done it.
And was that a similar experience to the kind of the experience you had after the initial discharge? And when the agency was put in 6 weeks later, was there much? What was the transition from that to the agency?
Different people, right? Obviously. Okay.
And but was their approach quite scattergun in the same way, kind of different times and a bit kind of random, or was it a little more organised?
It was a little more organised,
right?
But still not
personalised.
Well, it can't be really. I mean, I tried to get continuity of care. So that it was the same people coming, because too many different faces when you've got dementia is just not helpful, really. Like, who, and it's an invasion of the space that he had.
Did it distress him to have different people, do you think? Was it?
Yeah. I mean, some of them were good. Some of them weren't so good. The idea was that I could work upstairs, but I remember one carer left, hadn't told me he left. But the relief carer hadn't come. That was another time. You know, that was actually further down the line, because at the time we were still getting only 20 minutes a day. I was sleeping on the floor next to Lawrence's bed.
20 minutes a day, did you say, or 20 minutes a visit?
A visit.
Right, yeah.
But again, it had been done, so they're just standing there.
Right.
They might mop a floor or... I mean, they were nice enough people, and it's not their fault that, you know, they're sent from Ealing to here with like a 20-minute gap. Like, that's the care system. That's not the individual's fault.
Mm.
And I never blamed them for that, but I did blame the agency for not allowing decent transit time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, another time, three carers landed up at somebody else's house and nobody was here. But, I mean, it's so long ago and so much has happened since that it gets a bit confusing as to when the transition was. But the agency, I could not get on with the agency management at all. I found them basically... They blame the carers for everything, you know. And then when they sent an email to all the carers telling them that they weren't allowed to discuss their private life or say where they were going or what. So, well, how are they expected to build a relationship?
Yeah, they're in a very intimate setting. You want to be able to get on with the person, don't you?
You don't get much more intimate than having to wipe someone's bum.
True.
You know, it's like, you know, if you're not their partner, it's like... No, and I saw that, and I just thought, you know, this is not the way that they're just not treating these people right. And I decided that, despite all the positives of having an agency, in that you've got cover if there's someone off sick or whatever, I didn't like the way they were treated, and I would rather have people that were treated well.
Did you then have a eureka moment where you remembered back to the professional research you'd been asked to do about personal health budgets? What was the? Do you remember how you made that leap then? That, hang on a minute, maybe we could do this here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay. I contacted the CCG,
mm-hmm.
and I was told that personal health budgets were on hold.
Right.
So. Okay. And this went on for quite a while until I then the eureka moment. Hang on a minute. I've read the CARE Act 2014 and its reviewed one in 2015, and dementia patients are included in having personal health budgets. So I then wrote to, I tried them again, still told that. So I wrote to the head of the CCG, you know, the chair of the CCG, and I said, you know, according to the Health Act of blah, 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 it's da, 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 it says blur. Sorry about the blurs, but there's no point me repeating what it all says. But anyway.
We'll add links so people can look at that. Yeah. No, it's really important. I think you're right. You know, there was a right to have a personal health project.
Yeah, so I went to the chairman, and within 2 days I got a call from his secretary or PA or whatever. Said, oh yes, we'll sort that out. And so then I got some guy at the CCG who recommended Paula's organisation. Am I allowed to say?
Yeah, of course you are. Yeah, absolutely.
Rules.
Yep.
And said that they were reinstating personal health budgets now, and to go to Rules. So I went to Rules, and Paula became my. Is it a case manager or
Whatever terminology? Allocated to support.
She was allocated to support me, and she came over, which was great. She was brilliant. She went through the helping me with the risk assessment, care plan, support plan, and we submitted it. And they crossed this out and that out and this out and that out and reduced this and reduced that. Until they finally agreed it. The one thing I would not compromise on was the amount I was paying the carers. I felt that the job they had to do, even the waking carers, you had to be on 24-hour alert. I mean, they were 7-hour shifts. I didn't like people doing longer shifts, because if you're doing nothing but having to be alert, it's incredibly hard to do, I think. And they had to be alert because sometimes Lawrence could mobilise himself, but it was variable. So sometimes he'll just get up and walk. I mean, he did this in the hospital. They thought he was a visitor. He got dressed and he walked out. And then they realised, actually, he's the bloke that can't move. He would get up, but then he'd fall. So they had to permanently be on alert.
Also, I'd say that kind of really plays into what you said earlier about continuity and how important it is, because you need to know Lawrence to know that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, you don't want somebody coming in every week having to relearn that.
Yeah. And also know that he would forget what he was doing. Mm. He might ask you, I need to deliver a package to Sainsbury's. I wanted a poo. Or I want a Russian. I mean, now everybody's putting it on WhatsApp, you know, this doggy poo bin, and they've got poo tin. He was way ahead, because he used to say he wanted a Russian. And it took me a while to work out he meant poo tin. I don't know how he did it. But
so you've just described quite an intense care need there, around-the-clock support.
We took a while to get there, I have to say.
I was going to ask, what were the reasons, the justifications for not giving you the things that you'd asked for at the beginning?
Well, actually, it was a build-up as well, because I've missed out a part. I mean, there's so much gone on. But prior to the PHB, with the council, I was able to get the 20-minute three times a day thing up to so many hours so that I could go back to work. So they would come in, but nobody would be on nights. Or I think I got 2 nights cover. So if you haven't had no sleep, going to work and functioning is not really very good.
No.
No doubt also being alert, wondering what's happening, which carers come in and all the rest of it.
Yes, because they would be transferring over, and sometimes I'd get a call saying the carer hasn't come, so I'd have to literally turn around before I'd even got to Waterloo and get on the train back. So there were those sort of things that went on. There's quite a whole load of steps, really. So we eventually got up to 57 hours. The dementia specialist, she was great. She got me a mattress that I could put, so I was no longer sleeping on the floor. Which was great. The council person said that they could only cover 57 hours, and I wanted more. I wanted night shifts covered more than anything. And that was leading up to going to the CCG, really. The fact that the council could only do 57 hours. We had a matron who was brilliant. I have to say that there were four women who were pivotal in giving us support. One was the Parkinson's nurse, the community matron, Paula at Rules, and Teresa, the dementia person. So those four women, without those four women, I think I'd have landed up in hospital. So they were brilliant. And if you can get them on your side, they will be really helpful. But it took a while to get to have them. In the meantime, Lawrence had got what had they called it? An inguinal scrotal hernia, which they wouldn't operate on. And what that was doing, boys, I'm sorry, it's going to hurt you. But it pushed, this hernia pushed his, one of the testicles back up inside of his body and shifted the other to the other side. So painful. 18 months of him being in absolute agony, that they put him on morphine, created constipation. So then you're having to do suppositories. We didn't have the rail going up the wall at the time. So I'd come down one night and the night carer was hobbling. I said, what's the matter? He said, we have been walking up and down the hall. So he'd been supporting Lauren for 5 hours, walking up and down, up and down. And for those 18 months of agony that he was in, he would get angry that I wouldn't help him to die. And he would be asking me to help him die. Carers were hiding knives. And, you know, he was in a really bad state. But they refused to operate because it would either make the dementia worse or he could die on the operating theatre. Okay, so we left it. They then offered him a truss. I don't know if you've seen them. Like a medieval torture thing. It's like a pad that you then wrap round your waist and you tie it and you wrap it round your legs and you tie it. This is a man with Parkinson's and dementia. How is he going to not feel that he's being bound? These are all in tandem, really. We finally got a multidisciplinary team meeting that the matron organised, where there was the dementia nurse, the Parkinson's nurse, the carer, agency manager, the GP, the matron, the community psychiatric nurse. I mean, you name it, they were all sat round the table and we finally agreed to get 80 hours on the CCG.
And was there something, do you remember, was there a decision support tour? Did they go through lots of questions about aspects of his care and trying? Because I think they're probably looking at that point where we're saying, okay, this is going to be continuing healthcare funded by the health service. And then you're at that point,
We went from the council to the CCG for CHC.
Right, so continuing healthcare.
We're assessed, continual. Yeah.
Just for the purposes of recording, in case anyone,
That's fine. The CHC, and you're assessed as to whether you have to contribute financially or not.
Well, if it's health, continuing healthcare, you wouldn't have to contribute. But if it's social care, then there's potentially a financial assessment to assess your contribution.
Well, they did
so at the point it goes to health, if it's 100% health, you shouldn't have to make a contribution.
Well, we didn't have to because we didn't have the money. Right. But we had to go through an assessment anyway. And I don't know if that was to see if we qualified to go for CHC, for continuing healthcare. Would that have happened before they...
I don't know. I mean, we don't know the details, to be fair. But generally speaking, if you're assessed as continuing healthcare because it's health funded, it means that they're funding that package. And if it's health funded, you can't be asked to contribute to it.
Right. If it's council funded, prior.
Yeah, I think you probably had a financial assessment prior to that, when it was still council funded. But the moment after that multidisciplinary team meeting, it sounds to me like that was health. That was a concerted effort for them to say, look, this is a health concern. This is an ongoing health need and should be picked up by the NHS. And the CCG probably took the reins at that point, I would say.
Sounds about right.
And probably then your kind of contribution would have been out the window, but then you would have been probably dealing primarily with the CCG after that.
Yeah, we didn't deal with the council after that, no. Yeah. But they only gave us 80 hours a week. Because right. I mean, we had to go to that because the council could only do 57 hours.
Right, okay. So now you've got some hours for night care.
More hours covered. And I remember the Parkinson's nurse saying that she had a caseload of 500 people, three of which were extreme cases, extremely complex, and two of them were in their 90s, and then there was Lawrence, who was early 60s. And she said there is no care home that would take him because of the nature of his illness, the manifestations of his illness, and the challenging behaviour that came with it.
And I presume was that an option on the table that you were exploring?
He never wanted to go into a care home, so I was never, but it was obviously something that was put forward by, it's cheaper to put somebody in a care, much cheaper. So
the idea of a direct payment then, or a personal health budget, so if a direct payment is a form of a personal health budget or a way of receiving a personal health budget, wasn't, in your experience, kind of on the table or around as an idea as much as...
I think it had still been on hold because rules weren't involved at this time. It was still personal health budgets were... Because I think I first applied in... This was 2015 when he came home. So 2016 is when I applied. I didn't get a personal health budget until, I think, the first employee I got was in September 2017.
So 18 months, couple of years, really.
It
kind
took
of,
a
the
long
idea was
time
out, right,
to get the personal health budget.
And if we jump to that point then, so you've had support from rules. See, at this point, you're understanding that you're going to become an employer. I mean, there was so much going on that you've described, I guess, because, you know, we often talk about becoming an employer and what that means and how that can be quite daunting. But I think it's so helpful to hear you talk about your experience because it's daunting. But when faced with all of that stuff that you've had going on that you're then having to manage and cope with, your priority is Lawrence's well-being and how you're going to cope together in the house. I guess that puts that's really useful context, isn't it? So becoming an employer at that point wasn't such a huge deal for you. It was more about what you might get out of it.
You're looking more at what your needs are. I mean, the rest of it, I mean, you don't really know what you're doing. And there isn't anybody who's helping you until I got to the point where I could have, you know, I got rules involved. This was on my own, effectively.
So rules were telling you, look, we can do your payroll for you.
I asked if they would do that. Yeah.
And we can manage the money for you, the budget.
I asked them to do
account.
That.
Did insurance come into the conversation at that point?
Yes.
Yeah. And were you aware of the kind of legal advice you could get via insurance, for example, that you might need that? Was that kind of just in the background?
In my normal work head type capacity, all of those things would have gone through my head. In the situation that I was in, I was a mess.
Yeah.
I was a mess. And if I've been a patient representative for doing political work on behalf of patients wanting complementary medicine for 40 years. And if I found myself not knowing how to navigate the system and being in a mess, how is it going to be for most people? I'm not saying that, you know, that makes me an expert, but it does give me a leeway or a bit more information than most people who land up in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, you consider yourself adequately kind of...
at least a bit informed.
Informed. And you had done some research on personal health budgets, so you had something there.
So if you're actually just being discharged from hospital and you, on the whole, most people, I suspect, would not have a clue how to go about any of this. And if they are told, as I was, that you're not entitled to this or that this isn't available to you, you believe it. Mm. And this is really how we got involved, because they came and cut my budget with 7 days' notice.
Yeah. We'll, okay. Yeah.
And we will get onto that. But most people will have accepted it because that's what they're told they have to do, because this is the system. And most people go for it. I mean, for me, even now, I can't do a sequence of events and a sequence of thoughts of how we got into various positions, because most of the time I wasn't sleeping. And if you're not sleeping, or if your partner, who is usually the most gentle soul, quiet soul, is ripping your shirt off and accusing you of being his jailer, or you are not thinking about the legalities of this, or the, you know, I just know when he attacked, if he attacked a carer, I'd stand in the middle, because my duty of care was also to them as well as to him. You know, it's not a case of, well, you know, they're paid, they can take the punches. No, it doesn't work like that, you know, because you know that that's not the person, that's the illness or the drugs. I don't know which, but it certainly wasn't the person I'd known for 40 years.
So if I might ask about your PAs then, did you have some long-term PAs for that period, for the period that you were an employer then?
Did you
feel that relationship?
The very first PA I employed was one who had I poached from the agency.
Right, okay.
Because the agency had stupidly not got me to sign the thing saying I would not employ any of their carers. That's their fault, you know. I don't feel guilty. And he stayed with us to the end. And he was a night carer, and he did 4 nights a week. And while he was doing that, he was doing a degree in child psychology, which he now has, and he's now a social worker, which is great. But he could have left well before, because he got his degree about a year before he finished with us. But he said he would stay to the end. And he would have done.
Yeah, good carers are worth the weight in gold, aren't they?
Absolutely. The second carer I got through the rules interview. You know, they have a website for... And I got a phone call from a guy. Terrible reference. CV. He didn't know how to do CVs. But I spoke to him on the phone, and he had a good way about him. And I thought, okay, we'll take him on. So one was September 2017. The next one I employed, October 2017. The third one, we got... Paula from Rules helped me interview. He came over very personable, and he was good with Lawrence. So that was the third one. The fourth one, it was a woman. She was actually the second one. She was a South African woman. But she spent more time looking at the cat and playing. And she'd be helping Lawrence and talking to the cat as though he was a package. So after 6 months, I said, the probationary period? So it's not going to work. It's not going to work. You know, he's not an add-on to playing with the cat. So she went, and then we got another woman. The women weren't very good, actually, with Lawrence. I don't know why. But anyway. So we landed up having 3 women. They all left. Then we got another of the agency carers who had stayed with us as we were transitioning.
Yeah.
So I'd employed 2 carers. We're still using agency staff as well. And this one, I was incredibly impressed with this one, because he had to teach one of the new carers that we were going to employ directly. So he is getting agency pay of £8 an hour, and he is teaching the newcomer, who has no experience in care work at all, who's being paid £11 an hour. And he had been told by his agency manager not to do so. And he still did it. And he did it thoroughly. I mean, I was so impressed with how he was explaining how Lawrence needed this or did things this way or whatever. And I said to him, you know, I really wish you would come. And a couple of months later, he did. He actually did join us, which was great. So, and he stayed with us right to the end. In fact, he was with Lawrence when he died. And then the final one was another agency person who was working there and part-time with me.
So I know it's probably really difficult to do it, but what impact on Lawrence do you think having once that, you know, that team had been established? I know there were one or two changes on the periphery, but you've already said there two in particular stayed right through.
Oh, three stayed.
Three stayed right through. I mean, could is it possible to kind of summarise that, what you, the impact you think that had? Because you've described a lot of work. I mean, we do lots of talk around being an employer and responsibility against the benefits and barriers and everything. But it sounds, you're kind of making it so real in your description there. And I wonder, is it possible to, yeah, I mean, what difference did it make?
Well, first of all, Lawrence wasn't antisocial, but he wasn't a social person. He was a very self-contained individual. I mean, he travelled from Ethiopia to Cape Town on his own over 6 months. He worked as a landscape gardener on his own. He liked his own company. I often described it was like living with a bachelor, in a way. A bachelor who lived with a woman or something, I don't know. He hated chit-chat. So anybody who just, you know, how are we today? Blah, 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 would just rub him up the wrong way. But if you wanted to come in and have a proper conversation, he was all there, you know. So that's why I say he's not antisocial, but wasn't into chit-chat. And if that's all you had, just go away. He was not interesting. Just wouldn't give you the time of day. So the carers, one carer said to one of the other carers, it's all right for you, he likes you. And this carer, who'd been with us for a long time, turned around and said, he doesn't like anybody. He doesn't like any of us being here. He puts up with it because he has to. That's it. And when his son asked him, how do you feel about it? He says, I dread them coming, but I dread them going. So that's how Lawrence dealt with it.
Right.
And sometimes he would shake their hand and thank them for what they were doing. And another time he'd have them garroted in the bathroom. I've caught the thief. You know. But the Lawrence without the illness would have been the one that would have really appreciated what they were doing, why they were doing it. The ill Lawrence, they were jailers. They were thieves. They were bullies, they were, you know, and it would interchange. So sometimes he's shaking their hands, another time he's twisting their arm. I mean, I came down, I got a phone call 2 o'clock one morning. I'm outside, Lawrence chased me out. You just never knew. You never knew.
So in terms of being an employer then, I guess, what was your biggest, looking back over it, what do you think stands out as the issue that was really testing as an employer specifically? I mean, you've mentioned a few things already that might have been a bit of a headache, but what is there anything you can point to?
Three of my carers were, these are people, I mean, effectively, you have nothing in common with these people. They are strangers who become family. They become family because they see you warts and all. There is no pretense. They see you at your worst. That is it. I mean, that's, and that me included, not just Lawrence, me included. You know, they get to see who you are, nothing else. So they effectively become family, despite the fact you don't know each other. So it's a weird thing. It's like, I don't know. When you make it work, it's the best thing in the world because they're, as I say, no pretense. And they're there for you. They've got your back. You've got their back. You know, when it's at its worst, and I had this with only one, really, of my carers, where he was great with Lawrence. He had a nice way with Lawrence, but he would basically gainsay everything that I wanted done. If I said I want the medicines done, well, why do you want to give him that? Why not now? Yeah, basically, if I said I want the room blue, he'd say it's better green, and I'd send him to get the blue paint, and he'd come back with the green paint. That was the relationship. But he was good with Lawrence, and since my priority was that Lawrence had continuity of care, I put up with this person far longer than I ever would have done had I been employing him in a work capacity outside of the home. You know,
yeah.
In the probation period, he did a few things which I talked to him about, and I had mediation with rules. People can be very personable and can say the right things, and yes, I won't do that again, and so on. But once the probation period's over, boom. So there's this...
Were you aware that even after a probation period, within a two-year mark, you could still look to dismiss and not face an unfair dismissal case? Is that something that you were aware of?
No, because when I did want to, I mean, I'd given him verbal warnings, two written warnings. On the second written warning, he put a big, which they have to sign the written warning.
Mm-hmm.
He put a big cross through it saying, not true, I resign. So I said, thanks very much. When do you want to go?
So he didn't even accept your disciplinary outcomes. Yeah. Very much going
to And him. He was a bit nonplussed that I actually jumped at his resignation, because I think he was trying to call my bluff, and I think had I sort of capitulated and said, oh no, don't go, that would have been detrimental to the working relationship in any way. He would basically have had carte blanche to do and say anything he wanted, whenever he wanted. That, you know, there wasn't that respect, I think.
Mm.
And I don't understand why, because I hadn't got that problem with any of the others. You know, all the other carers were, you know, if I pulled them up, and I think if you talk to any of them, they would say that if I pulled them up, how I did it and why I did it had been fair. Because I am, and it sounds big-headed, but I am fair. And I wouldn't pull them up unless it impacted on Lawrence. And that was my concern. That was the only time. So, no, but this one was... I did ring the insurance people about this person, and I was told that I couldn't just dismiss him. Had to be disciplinary. There had to be a tribunal. He was unable to bring somebody with him and all of that. So I did get that advice. But... what do you do when a relationship with the carer, who is, as I said, effectively part of the family? I mean, that's how intimate the relationship has become. That that you can't bear to have them there anymore, but you have to have them there for another 6 months while you go through.
In the first season, Rachel and I have a conversation in one of the episodes about SOSR, don't we, Rachel? I don't know if that's what you're...
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty with... essentially, what we were talking about in that programme was where the reason isn't related to conduct. It's actually related to something other, something very substantial. Substantial reason where you can get to the end of your tether and you're thinking there is no other way forward. And there is a couple of pieces of case law that tackle that in the individual employer setting. So it's particularly relevant where you have somebody receiving the care and perhaps isn't in a position to explain themselves, but the employer recognises that they are not wanting to work with the carer. And that, you know, even if the employer is thinking, well, we don't know why. There's no actual good reason for this. The very fact of the matter is that there's nothing the employer can do to fix it. Even if it means that the person receiving the care is being completely irrational and unreasonable, what more can you do? So under circumstances like that, you may well have good reason to go forward with the dismissal, even if the carer has done absolutely nothing wrong. And then, of course, we had another case where the employer was the recipient of the direct payment. And again, it wasn't strictly conduct related. It was really, it was a little bit of both of them, I think, both parties had simply fallen out. And it made it quite clear that they couldn't move forward. Now, the advantage we've got after a number of years of direct payments being in play is we're seeing that employment tribunals are recognising that this is an employment scenario where you're not necessarily going to apply the rules in quite the same way that you would to a business or a commercial setup. The judges are recognising the intimacy of that relationship. Everything that you've been describing is being seen by the tribunals and will be taken into consideration in the deciders. I think the difficulty is, though, in the story that you've just told about the employee, it was predominantly conduct related, and that's why the relationship broke down. So I kind of agree that we probably would have approached that through disciplinary processes as well. Now, if you've got somebody who's committed an act of gross misconduct, and I know you were telling us a story earlier, I think that chap had, he disappeared out of the country, hadn't he? He'd just gone completely AWOL with no good reason and not to be attending work. That's the sort of process where I could have guided you through getting through it quickly. When they return to work, or at least back in the country, get them into a disciplinary and get that decision made quickly. It should not last for 6 months. And good, robust advice would get through you. Good, robust advice would make that process a lot quicker and put you in a solid position sooner. So we need to make sure that you've got all direct payment employers are getting good, strong advice and have got the confidence that they're doing the right thing. Whilst not, I think it's too easy sometimes for advisors to just simply think about the employment law issues and forget what you're telling us, forget the story. You know, they've got to be thinking along the lines of being in your position. This is somebody who you are working with very intimately in your own home. And I feel very passionate about making sure that anybody who is advising employers, don't just apply the law strictly. Let's think about the circumstances as well.
Yeah, just imagine if you had to have them in your home.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you described so well how it felt, and yeah, it felt unbearable. How do I manage this situation? And as Rachel said, you'd had these kind of little bits of conduct, things going wrong, leading up to the situation you did describe.
And just for the benefit of anybody who might be listening to it, you said earlier that you'd gone through disciplinaries, you'd given warnings, written warnings. If for all employers, it's really important that those sorts of warnings are done. Initially, you might want to give an informal, but those sorts of warnings then actually follow a disciplinary meeting, because in doing so, you're building up a disciplinary record that follows the ACAS code of practice. And that actually means that you get to the dismissal point an awful lot quicker, much, much quicker. You're able to.
So I had done that, hadn't I, with giving verbal warnings, which I'd written down and recorded and put in the file. Those were the verbal ones. There were two of those. I mean, there were lots of verbal ones, but two formal verbal ones, one with rules.
And had you gone through a disciplinary meeting with the employee before you gave that written warning?
That was a result of that.
Right.
Yes. And then I did a second one where there wasn't a meeting, because having a meeting with he would not let you speak. You open your mouth to say what was wrong and he was at you.
And were you seeking advice not just from rules at that point? Or because in some cases...
I went to the insurer.
I was going to say, because in some cases, if benefits of people listening, I suppose we often talk about a kind of hybrid of advice. So you might be seeking advice from somebody like Paula at Rules, who might say to you, well, who are you insured with? Let's contact the insurer. And, you know, for me, in my background, direct payment support, that would be, if I was supporting you, that's kind of how I would approach that and say, well, you know, let's bring the insurer in. Let's speak to Mark Bates or
which whatever I think it is. Paula wouldn't.
And make sure we're following that advice so that, you know, you can be guided by Rachel or someone like Rachel who can lead you to you know, the conclusion.
It was Paula who always advised me to go to.
And I'm sure she would have been doing that. So, I mean, that's the message. It so often I think people describe, like you did, how frustrating it'd be. What do I do? The relationship's completely broken down. And there's a whole catalogue of reasons for that. But if, without the body of evidence that Rachel just described, and which you're obviously doing, it's very, very difficult to unpick, isn't it? And then it becomes even more stressful because you're asked suddenly to gather lots of evidence and things, and you might not have it. It can be really tricky.
We've talked about some of the difficulties of being an employer. If you were talking to somebody here today who was thinking about taking on a direct payment and were a little nervous of taking on staff, what would be your top tips, whether that be how to handle the good, the bad, the ugly?
Yeah, well, if you, things you wish you knew, then someone in your position perhaps now who might be listening.
I think before it gets to the point where you are going through the process of getting direct payments, get as much information as you can. And that is not going to be easy because it's just not there. There needs to be a guidebook of what to do when someone is discharged from hospital who is going to need ongoing care. There needs to be a simple guidebook of who to go to. Because although Age UK helped me, it wasn't always the most informed advice. It's a bit like going to the Citizens Advice Bureau. Depends who you get the best advice or you don't get the best advice.
So a clear pathway. Try and identify a pathway.
A pathway. And really, it would be great if someone were to prepare such a book. You know, you can go to the council initially, get a social worker, but they'll only do so many hours. Is that going to help you? When it gets past those hours, then you have to go to the continuing healthcare.
Did you feel that the social workers were sufficiently well informed about direct payments?
No, not at all. Because at one point he told me we could employ a live-in carer, and then I was told, oh, no, you can't. And I have to say that the social worker we got, initially you felt like it was a bit hare and tortoise. You're the hare and he was the tortoise. But the tortoise got there. He had to increase the hours that we were getting to their maximum. I think he had to go in front of a panel of 3 or 4 or 5 people to plead our case. And because of his tenacity, his like feet rooted in the ground, however slow, I think he beat them into submission. I'm like, we're never going to get rid of him unless we say yes, you know. But until that point, I felt that he didn't move at all. But at that point, I realised that actually he was there. It's just he had a job to do, but he had to do it within the confines of his employer's requirements. And when his back was against the wall and it was a case of fighting for us, he did. And as I say, I think they just capitulated to get rid of him, because I think that it's usually like a 15-minute interview. Why should they have these extra hours? 45 minutes later, you know, this is all like pushing him out the door. So he was great. So you want your social worker on your side. We had the same social worker from the get-go. I understand from Jade, another member of the community, that you now get different people. So they're not even people who can see the changes that are going on. If a social worker came that hadn't known Lawrence in one state, say he was doing really well, they'd think, well, you know, he got up and went to the loo himself. He held his cup of coffee himself. Doesn't need help. But another one would come and he wouldn't be moving, or he wouldn't he'd get up and fall down or whatever. I mean, they wouldn't see. There's nobody other than the carers who actually saw the varying states. Not his family, nobody.
So I think then information. Pathway. Another thing I think that jumps out, and you've just highlighted there when you talk about your social worker, and also when you talk about your PAs, but earlier on you said something about four key women that somebody, and so good people then, making good, recognising the good people that are there, that are really, you know, pushing the boat out to help you and really kind of working with those people. Yeah. Is that another thing? That's
another thing. Yeah. Because if you need care, you're going to at some point have to deal with the community staff, aren't you? The community matron. We had a brilliant one. She's left. Unfortunately, she left beforehand. We never saw another community matron. We got a phone call after that one left saying, "We've had the hernia operation. You don't need to see us. Just call us if you need us." That was it. So no relationship at all there. The dementia specialist, the Parkinson's nurse, they were great. The CPN, he was good. He would get the psychiatric doctor to come here rather than me trying to get Lawrence into a car to get, you know, things like that make a heck of a difference, because you have an appointment, and if you can't get him out the house, what do you do? So then you're a didn't attend. And it's not a didn't attend because you didn't want to attend, because you couldn't get him up. Oh, no, one more thing.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, downfall. If you've got any doubts about the relationship with the carers that you have employed, get rid of them in the probation period. Don't take their word for it that it's going to change, because once the probation period's over, they don't care anymore.
Proactive management. Yeah.
And seek advice. Don't be shy. Be brave. Seek advice. Get some advice coming in.
And it's hard because you're usually tired, because you're on alert. You're on alert even when you're asleep. You're alert to any noise, to anything that's going on. You're not really sleeping. So, yeah.
Good advice.
Brilliant. So the ILG community then?
Oh, yes.
The ILG community. So Independent Living Group, partner organisation to Markbates Limited. We have the fantastic ILG support that provide our legal advice that Rachel heads up, which is brilliant. And we have something called the ILG community. And we have a steering group. So what do you know of the ILG community steering group?
Okay, well, I first heard about the ILG community group from you, David.
You did.
And you twisted my arm and said, "You've got to go on, because your experience with employing people through a personal health budget, same really issues as a DP, and also the fight that I had later with the CCG on the budget. You felt that although Lawrence has now died, the experience I had is lived experience and could be of some help to other people who may be facing those difficulties." And actually, I say you twisted my arm. You didn't really, because I felt so strongly that this is such an important thing. There is no voice out there for independent employers of they call them PAs. I find that a bit weird. I used to always call mine PCAs, personal care assistants, because personal assistant, you think of a chief executive and in some business or whatever.
And I think we have to be open to different terminologies. I will say that here, because I've been challenged for using different terms, and I think it's what it means to you and what you mean by it.
So I'm just going to call them carers, because
that's cool.
Most of them are carers. Some of them are a bit iffy, but carers, real carers, the ones, it comes from the heart. It's nothing about their training. It's nothing about the job they're in. It's about what's coming out of them. And you cannot do a caring job properly without having it in your heart. And those are the people that are worth their weight in gold. And I was lucky enough to have several of them.
The ILG steering group, you're involved.
The ILG steering group is great in that up until this point, in my understanding, is there is not a single organisation representing people who are employing carers for whatever reason throughout the UK who has a seat at the table. You've got agencies that are represented in government committees. You've got nursing homes and care homes sitting at the table, but you haven't got independent employers. And that is why I felt the ILG community could and should become a strong, coherent group of people with a voice that could then go to the table of Parliament or anywhere else where they're discussing social adult or even just social care, social health care. And at the moment, we're a steering group. As we grow, we hope to sort of have people come forward, and then we'll go for an election, you know, not an election. People will say, I would like so-and-so to be on that group. And then we'll have a proper committee as opposed to a steering group. At the moment, we're just setting the terms of reference. And I say just, we're not. We've already got a seat on the Department of Health's adult social care working group, working advisory group, WAG. And we're going to different other groups and explaining what the ILG is. But it's a start. And it, for me, if we don't have a voice, I don't want the ILG to be just a talking shop, just shoulders for people to have a moan or I've got a question. I think it should be there to make a stand politically and influence any policy that is done.
Yeah, and I would add to that, Sato, I think you're absolutely right, and that's what's so exciting about working with you and other members of the steering group, who we're going to interview as part of this season, which is fantastic. And you've really expressed it all throughout this interview, actually, this podcast, and I thank you for that. I really do. Thank you so much. And I think the other element of the ILG steering group, the membership is growing, so we'll put a link on all of these podcasts so people can jump on if they are listening to this, whether you're already an employer thinking about doing it. Because one of the most rewarding things for me in the last sort of 6 to 12 months that we've been doing it is watching that Facebook group grow and the actual kind of engagement happen. And it is the questions
and people answering and sharing information. Brilliant.
Right.
That's something that for me, I just think is so important. I've been advising individual employers for so long. And through all of those years, what we find is that there are common problems that come up again and again and again and again. And I've always thought, why don't people know? Why aren't they told that there are people that you can go to for more help and pointed in the right direction? And it's such a frustration. And us having this opportunity to get more information out there, to share this with individual employers and let them know that there is a network, that there is a system that they can turn to for further guidance, is just incredible. And I'm so pleased.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I would like then to thank the ILG group, ILG, Independent Living Group, not the community, for having the idea that it's an innovative idea, and the backlash of people thinking that there's a vested interest in this. I would say join the community and you'll see actually there is no intrusion. There's no input from the insurers in any way, shape or form. We can go to them. We can go to somebody else. They do not tell us how to do things. We're completely independent. And I would like to say thank you to the ILG for making available templates, giving certain advice, answering some of the questions on the Facebook, but at no point ever promoting themselves. I think that that shows a generosity that is seldom found, sorry to say, in business, but it is. And it's done from the right spirit, and out of things being done from the right spirit can only go well. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. What a great way to end. I don't think we can follow that, can we? Thanks, Sato.
Can I take the handcuffs off
yeah,
now?
Yeah, let's do it.